Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michaela Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. Today, Chantelle and I are talking with Belle Parnell-Berry, who is the co-founder of the European Race and Imagery Foundation and who lives in The Hague in the Netherlands. Hi, Belle.
Hi there.
First of all, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing through the European Race and Imagery Foundation.
For sure. So we started in 2013. We came together to organise a conference about blackface from a European standpoint. We wanted to take some sort of departure from the US-centric notion of blackface and really think about its history in Europe, how it's practised in contemporary terms, and what kind of movements and strategies are being used to challenge it and criticise it. We had 15 speakers or so at that first conference from all over Europe, and we had a really nice audience attendance as well. And basically, we realised, I think initially we got together as a collective to organise a one-off event, and then we decided we wanted to do more, that there was more to say, and not just about blackface, but about all different types of systemic racism in Europe, and really try and develop a European vocabulary and discourse about racism as well. So taking inspiration from very sophisticated Anglophone disciplines, but finding a way of talking about European racism in its own way. So we had a second conference, and we also launched a longitudinal research project, which is about Sinterklaas, which is a very Dutch tradition. It's celebrated in different parts of Europe as well, but the way it's celebrated here is basically bigger than Christmas. And Sinterklaas or Saint Nicholas is always accompanied by Black Piet or Zwarte Piet in Dutch, who has, up until contemporary times, been very much portrayed as a caricature of a black enslaved person. And when I moved here about 10 years ago, it was being challenged, but in a very kind of small scale, piecemeal way. It was very difficult to get people together to talk about it. People felt very unsure, very unsafe. The response to criticising it in any way was very violent and still is. But I think the tone of conversation has changed a lot over the last 10 years. And so what IRF has been trying to do is capture that shift in conversation through year-on-year data collection. So we're about to actually start the fifth year of that, where we go into shops and we capture what they're selling, and we put that alongside the nature of the debate and the discussion and the work that's being done by the activists in the Netherlands to see, you know, how they're pushing this and how they're being enabled or prevented from changing culture, essentially, and changing a way of understanding Dutchness. And it's very much about who gets to be truly Dutch. Also trying to question this notion of tolerance, you know, Dutch tolerance, and that seeing that as a good thing and just taking it for granted as well. So that's one of the projects that's at the forefront of what IRF does. And I think it speaks to a much broader idea of how IRF sees itself as in questioning who gets to belong in Europe, who gets to shape European culture and values and traditions, who gets to critique history in Europe, and who's allowed to envision its future as well.
Yeah, I think it speaks very much to some of the things that we've been concerned about, doesn't it, Chantelle, about
Yeah.
those questions of who counts as European as well as who counts as British that we've been tracking through the project. You said that you've been in the Netherlands for about 10 years, is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been coming out here regularly for 10 years, certainly, and then I moved, like actually just kind of picked up all my stuff and moved in 2011. So yeah, 8 years for sure, yeah.
And did you have any sense of the extent to which those questions about who counts as Dutch were exclusionary before you moved there?
For sure, because by then I was really kind of in deep into the, you know, the anti-racism movement. So I think I was shocked the first couple of times I went to, like, community meetings when I was sitting around. I, first of all, didn't envision there'd be that many black people in the Netherlands, which says a lot about the Netherlands and how it portrays itself.
Yeah, or how we imagine the Netherlands from Britain.
I wouldn't have been so surprised had I been in France, for example, I think. But, yeah, very much how we look at... And when I would talk to relatives as well, like, and tell them about the activities I was involved in, they would also be like, but are there even any black people in Holland? Like, are you doing this by yourself?
It's so weird, isn't it, how strong that, or how embedded that narrative is that black people, people of colour, aren't European yeah. and aren't living in Europe. Like, it blows my mind every time it sort of comes up.
You, of course, you know that there was the East India Company in Indonesia and parts of, you know, Sri Lanka, and you know that there were slaves, and you know about the Dutch Caribbean, and you know about Suriname, but you don't learn the details, and you don't learn the kind of long-term legacy of any of that. And people do walk around questioning, you know, why are there so many Antillians moving here? Well, they're Dutch, they have Dutch passports, you know. Not understanding that in the 70s, you know, people were kind of invited to come, you know, they were told, like, come over here, there are great opportunities for you. And, oh, how come they speak Dutch? So, I remember actually speaking to you, Chantal, the first time I spoke to you, and you were like, oh, I have a friend that lives in The Hague. And white. But The Hague is, like, one of the most black cities in the country.
It's so interesting because... Yes, this is my partner's friend who lives in The Hague, yeah, with his wife and kids. In my head, I imagine The Hague, because of the sort of job that he's got, and that's my sort of connection to The Hague, as being very white, middle class, Dutch, like where all the corporate people live sort of thing. But after speaking to you, I was like, oh, wow, no, there's you were telling me about your street and stuff and how it is multi-ethnic and multiracial.
So... I was like, oh, okay, first things first, there are black people in Holland, there's racism in Holland, Holland isn't even Holland, it's the Netherlands, and then there's segregation, like, the racism is so bad that there's segregation, like, it was shattering every image I'd ever associated with the country, like, being this happy, lovely, inclusive place of equality and human rights, and, one, you know, learning more and more and more about the colonial history and the various anti-racism movements that there have been throughout the 20th century, that it doesn't start really even with our generation. You have to learn about people like Anton de Kom and, you know, the work that he was doing around, you know, before and during the Second World War. So I can imagine also to a white Brit who's never thought about Britain in this way, never mind life, coming here... Very much also like, you know, your friend loving it here. You can have a very, very comfortable quality of life here for almost everybody. Now, obviously, we have communities that do not get everything that they should or be, and that's really, really terrible, and we need to change that. But for the most part, people that move from Britain are not having that experience. They're not even seeing that experience because it's so segregated here.
They could live without really recognising... that there were issues around racism in the Netherlands.
Well, if, you know, let's just continue to use Chantal's friend as an example.
they won't mind.
if he and his family live where I think they do, they wouldn't even see any of this stuff. They wouldn't...
Would they see people of colour? I think because they're used to living in places that are, like London, for example... I think if it wasn't like that, maybe they would say it's really white. Like, as in they would say it's really white because they're not used to that, even though they are white themselves. So
I always kind of like imagine The Hague, for example, as being divided into four parts. So you've got kind of like the northeast, which I think is where Chantal's friend lives. And, really very international, but international when in the way that you think of expats. Okay. So diplomats, people who have been moved, they move from country to country for their work, for their company. I would say for that reason, it's quite mixed. You know, you can have people really from all over the world, but they are very wealthy people from all over the world.
Yeah.
That's where you have all the international schools as well. And then you like, juxtapose that with like the southeast corner of our city, which is also very mixed, also quite international, but very working class. And you know, in a kind of mainstream discourse, you wouldn't describe those people as expats. You would describe those people as immigrants. I don't see a big difference, which is a huge problem in my opinion. And then you've got other communities that just not have a choice. They're just labelled as immigrant. And with that comes a whole host of ideas.
Some of the stuff that you were talking about, Belle, particularly in getting us to reimagine the Netherlands and talking about the anti-racist movements you've been involved in, talking about ERIF as well, like it also makes me think about some of the academics that are trying to do work on demystifying this, yourself included. Like, look at the queer Emma Julu, Francesca Zimbardo, Leah Basil, like all this stuff is sort of, it's coming into the mainstream more, and it's really disrupting how we think about Europe as a whole. And I think it's so important, and it's having this work coming through, it makes me feel less depressed about the other Brexit narratives that pervade academia in general and public media discourse.
Although,
yeah,
having said that,
yeah. Sorry, I'm being a bit utopian here.
What is slightly more depressing about that is the fact that although that all of that work's out there, and of course that work has a far longer history
as well.
Of course,
yeah.
That it is not recognised in those Brexit narratives, whether that is the public perception of what Brexit means, whether that is what our politicians think here and in other European countries. But also, as Belle has written herself in her article for Galden, even perhaps it hasn't made its way into how the campaign groups who are fighting for the rights of British citizens in the EU, and I would also say for EU citizens in the UK, they are not aware of the problems that they reproduce through their agenda, which doesn't recognise this alternative Europe.
Yeah. Or they do recognise, but they don't care. This is what I'm trying to sort of grapple with at the moment. Yeah. Like these absences within the whole Brexit debate, like it's so evident that bordering and citizenship
is right at the core.
Yeah. Yet you're refusing to see how exclusionary this has been for years and years and years. So is it that they don't know, or is it that they don't want to know? It's sort of what
I think it's the latter. And I think that is really how white privilege operates. It's about having a choice to turn away from something and choosing to turn away from it so that you can go on and have a lovely day. And I think even like before the referendum, I'd come across, you know, other Brits or other, you know, European immigrants, you know, having a lovely time with them or like at work, or maybe you'd meet through mutual friends and having a drink and getting along, and you'd think, okay, they're on a level, they get stuff, and they're going on and on and on about how wonderful it is to live in the Netherlands. And again, like, for all intents and purposes, for someone who has a fairly decent education, who had the money, like, to come over here and immediately have a comfortable life, moving over here is seamless. It's wonderful. Everybody does speak, well, most people speak English. You're not, if you have a really good job in a good company that's international, you won't have to learn. So you never have the stress of that. You don't have the stress of an immigration exam or an integration exam, I should say. You know, you don't have to deal with any of that stuff. And people are generally friendly and treat you really well. But at the same time, even with all that privilege and all of that luxury, if you are black, you still get treated in a certain way. You know, you still have to deal with profiling. You still have to deal with people making racist jokes. You're still confronted with anti-black racism, really like vitriolic anti-black racism for 2 months solid every single year in winter. You're still asked where you're really, really from on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Still have people touching your hair and pulling your hair and you all those kind of everyday microaggressions and all the really violent political stuff as well. When you bring that up around Brits or other Europeans who you think will get it because you think that they are, you know, intellectually sound and that they're well-travelled and that they read The Guardian and all this stuff, they don't get it. And I think that's a choice.
But they don't get it here either, so it just doesn't surprise. It doesn't surprise me that they don't get it in the Netherlands. Yeah, but
that's why I was disheartened to see that the Remain campaign didn't reflect any of that.
The
post-Remain campaign, in terms of what we're now experiencing, especially on the continent,
it's even worse.
They're choosing to turn away from these factors. It's like, if I had honestly said, in response to the Gaudam article I'd written, somebody had posted it in the group, it got all kinds of criticism.
Just for the listeners, Belle, this is a Facebook group for British people living in the Netherlands.
Yeah, specifically has the aim to kind of protect the rights of Brits living in the Netherlands post-Brexit. And somebody had posted a very critical article I'd written for Gaudam, which was really me kind of going through my feelings as a woman of colour living abroad in this time, trying to figure things out for myself and write it all down and share it for people that might relate. Not me necessarily wanting to start any drama with them, but somebody took that out of my hands and posted it in the group, and it started all kinds of drama. And as is always the case, I was just like labelled as a troublemaker who wanted to push identity politics and wanted to just offend people and didn't actually have any other agenda other than wanting to upset people. But then they also were like, well, she felt this way, why didn't she just post it? Why did she have to write it in an article? And I'm like, if I had honestly come to you people and said, with all due respect, guys, your protests and your petitions and your meetings are great, but can we also reflect what the experience is going to be like for Black British people? Because our experience is going to be even worse than the stuff you're talking about for different reasons, or not even necessarily just Black people, like
people who are already discriminated against within the places that they live and back in Britain before they left.
Mm.
Because one humongous privilege is going to be distorted, it might have a knock-on effect on how you get treated, because your access to services might change. And not just that, but because of rising populism and discrimination towards certain groups is growing, the added knock-on effect of you being British and being singled out in a way that we weren't before, I emphasise other forms of oppression and discrimination. For me as a Black woman, being Black is one of those aspects, but that could be for anybody that's oppressed or marginalised, that can be the same.
I think it's, you know, what you're trying to do is highlight the likely uneven outcome of a change to people's rights, which interplays with existing axes of extensive social injustice and inequality. But yet, when people take that blanket approach, which is to say, oh, we're all having our rights changed, they focus only on the legal dimensions, which don't have any recognition of how those things are lived and experienced by people, depending on all sorts of different factors and all sorts of inequalities already. So
it might be quite a good thing to bring in now, Mikkel, is what you've sort of been reflecting on in terms of the hierarchies of privilege and how these are sort of, as we come into this near no deal moment, these are starting to seep out. So it's not necessarily just people of colour, Black people that are living in the EU27 that are going to be possibly the first to have these intense
always had
that intense bordering experience that's sort of maybe now seeping into other marginalised groups as well.
Yeah, so for example, we also know that people's experience will not just be because they're a person of colour, it might specifically be because they're a woman of colour.
Yeah.
It might also be that what we're seeing is some of the inequalities that were written into freedom of movement, which discriminates disproportionately against disabled populations, mean that as the terms of freedom of movement are enforced for British people, some of those people who are disabled find themselves in a position where they're found not to be lawfully resident in the state in which they live, and therefore find themselves lacking access to healthcare, lacking access to social care, those types of things. So we start to see those things coming out.
And believe it or not, there probably is a person with a British passport that is disabled and a person of colour as well.
I'm always very uncomfortable when I'm in a group of people when we're talking about remaining at least leaving with a deal, and then that conversation turns to romanticising the EU.
Yeah.
that's definitely not something that I think the EU needs to be reformed. And I know that there was also a Lexit movement. You know, there were people that were like, you know, we don't want to be a part of this institution anymore because of what's happening on the borders of the EU and how fortress Europe is being created and what and who's harmed in that process on a day to day. That I completely agree with. I felt that we would be better off staying part of the EU and reforming it from the inside than leaving it and becoming our own mini fortress Britain.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that narrative about Europe being this kind of almost utopia compared with racist and xenophobic Britain, which is how I see it coming out in a lot of the narratives we hear, is a really, really flawed narrative, which neglects the fact that Britain's history and Europe's history are entirely intertwined, and they're intertwined in ways that have always been built on kind of racist violence, racial othering, exclusionary practices. Europe, at its heart, was a white social formation. What do you think has changed for you now that I think the Netherlands have kind of rolled out some kind of surety for British citizens?
Yeah, no, so actually just a couple months, I think, after it was published, it was almost like they were responding to the article. Like, it's okay. They announced that if you've been living here for 5 years at the time that the UK leaves the EU, then they're just going to continue to treat you as an EU citizen, because basically the rule in the Netherlands, and I'm not sure about the other 27, but the rule is that if you've been here for 5 years, you're automatically, and you're an EU citizen and you've been here like legally in the Netherlands and documented in the correct way, that you are entitled to a permanent residence permit, and you basically only just have to really ask for it. They were like, because you'd be entitled to that anyway, we're just going to give that to you guys because, you know, what's changed? Nothing will have changed. You still have jobs here. You've got families, you've got lives, which is incredibly generous. It's, you know, shocking that they can't do that for more people, but...
Although that's just EU law. Permanent residence is just EU law. If you've lived there for 5 years, it's unconditional, so...
So, I mean, but it was kind of like... I think everybody knew that they had that right, but on the other hand, you never really needed to have a residence permit if you were in EU. So people weren't using it. People weren't kind of applying for that because it doesn't do anything. But now, suddenly it does. They were just kind of highlighting, you have that, we're going to make sure that everybody that's been here for 5 years has that document. We all got letters at the start of this year saying this is your kind of interim permit in the event. I mean, bear in mind, at that point, we were going to potentially be leaving without a deal on the 29th of March. And I think that was kind of the reason for being like, we need to get these people fixed up with documents because the Netherlands hates to not be bureaucratically organized. So they were like, these people need documents. Some of them will be on vacation when this happens and to get back in the country, da, da, da. They're going to need their stuff together. So,
God, it's mental how much that has to be thought through. Yeah.
And then it didn't even happen. We were like, you know, great that we have the document and great that we know if we do still leave without a deal, that we know how the Dutch are going to deal with it. That's fantastic. We know we don't have to actually do anything. But at the same time, I'm much more focused on, I'm very concerned about the way that we have these angry white men in power right now and what that means for people like my mother and my sister who are in the UK. I'm sitting pretty, I'm happy, I have everything I need. There's definitely a lot about the Netherlands that I want to change and I'm working to change.
I know we've got to wrap up soon, but I just wanted to just quickly, Belle, to get you to speak to slightly, because it is something that's come up with other people of colour and black people that I've spoken to that are in a similar situation to you, is sort of thinking about how bordering, particularly when you're travelling, had played out prior to Brexit and how what's happening with that post-Brexit. So I'll give the example of people saying that, like, I definitely experienced racialisation and people sort of monitoring me in a different way with my passport. But sometimes that Britishness actually made people, for example, in France, treat me a lot better than they would, let's say, black French nationals. But then sort of noticing in this post-Brexit era that there having to have different documentation to prove your Britishness is almost meant that there's another layer of sort of racialization that's going to possibly come to fruition. Could you speak to that just a little bit of your own experience?
For sure. I mean, I know that there's been situations in the Netherlands, like just going about every, you know, your life here, yeah, and having to produce a legal document just to show who you are. I mean, they're very hot on having ID here. They really like for you to have a legal form of ID, yeah, with you at all times. And if you don't have it, you can be fined. So, yeah, you know, you can have a driving license or, you know, a residence permit, which is like a little car, you know, so anything that's legalized that can show who you are is fine. But I've been asked in scenarios where I've been asked to produce that document where my residence permit was as well, as a British, showing you a British passport, speaking to you with a British accent, with a very anglicised name as well, you know, where is your residence permit? And that was always a bit weird, and that was before the referendum. So with regards to travelling, I mean, at the moment I'm still able to use a passport that gets me through automated gates, so I don't actually have that much interaction with any passport personnel, even though in the past they've really kind of like, well, where, you know, I was born in Ely in Cambridgeshire, and people are like, well, where is Ely?
What do they want you to say? Like, I just...
Is there a place called Ely in Nigeria or something? I don't know.
Yeah.
They're just really like, were you really born in Britain, is what they're saying, you know, and how long are you going to be here, and why are you here? And I've had those questions with personnel, and I think that's a pretty typical experience. And it's never... I've never, like, been... taken aside and we're going to look into this further. It's always been fine. I've always allowed to kind of just go on, but I haven't had that experience for, you know, we try not to fly too often anyway. I'm really anticipating this document, this letter that I got from the IND at the start of the year. Am I going to be asked for that? And I really do anticipate kind of being asked for that. And what's that going to mean?
I think what you're trying to point to is that some people in those scenarios are more prone to being questioned for their right to cross that invisible line between countries. And that's always been the case. It's not just to do with Brexit. And what you're anticipating is that experience that you've had just continuing indefinitely into the future, with you being questioned for those various documents, where other people won't be, where the people who still... fit that image of what a British person is who lives abroad might not be questioned in the same way.
And I think another complication really for me and my family as well, and I suspect so many other families living across the EU, is that we are a mixed family. You know, I have a very light-skinned son. I'm not dark-skinned, but I'm certainly not light-skinned either. Mm. And he gets mistaken, you know, and placed in all kinds of different ethnic ideas, you know, before people think that he's mine, yeah, on a day-to-day basis. So as a family, we've been questioned before when we've been travelling together, you know, who does his child belong to?
Mm.
And there's already quite strict and stringent border checks in place when you travel with a child that doesn't share your surname.
Yes, I know.
It feels like it's about to get worse. Even in my own family, I've sort of been tracking it over the last 2 years and I can see it's getting worse.
Yeah.
They're getting a lot more strict. And I think, you know, just parents travelling by themselves anyway is being looked at a lot more, like for kidnapping reasons. But then, especially if you don't have the same surname, which me and my son don't. Yeah. He has a very Dutch surname because he has a dad's surname. And, well, his whole name is quite Dutch, actually. So I can really see a scenario where they're like, you're British, so first of all, do you have a right to be here? You are here with a Dutch white child.
Yeah. You
know? What is this? You know, and obviously there's a very, very clear, simple explanation, which is going to be true for a lot of families, regardless of their background, because there's so many mixed families living in the Netherlands. There are so many, like, love unifications here, where people have met somewhere, one has moved over, they've got married, they've had kids. So it shouldn't be an othering experience, but I know that it will be.
Yeah. Wow, that's been a real tour de force.
Yeah, that
has.
Thank
you so much.
So good. Really good.
So it was really nice to talk to you guys and to work through some ideas. Yeah,
there's so much to think about.
Absolutely.
So much still.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Michaela Benson, and produced by Emma Halton at Art of Podcast. The series is part of a UK and a Changing Europe funded research project, Brexit Brits Abroad, that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU27. We're really keen to hear from you about the issues and concerns we address in the programme, so please do get in touch with any thoughts, queries and questions. You can find our contact details on our webpage, Brexit Brits Abroad, or get in touch via social media. We're on Twitter at BrexpatsEU, and we have a Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. Finally, in case you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so on both iTunes and Google Podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.